Greetings, urban farmers, gardeners, and healthy food visionaries. Farmer Greg here, and welcome to the 801st episode of the Urban Farm Podcast, where every day we work to educate and inspire you to become part of your food revolution. Today's podcast is a replay of our monthly seed chat that we do live. You can sign up to join us live every month at seedchat.org. Also, we discuss many links in this episode, and they can be found at the show notes at urbanfarm.org/801 seed chat. Enjoy. Welcome, welcome, everybody. Greg Peterson coming to you from our new farm, Goodness Grows Organics. And I am here with Bill McDormand. We do this monthly for, oh my gosh, probably 7 years now, right, Bill?
I stopped counting.
So we just get together once a month and have fun. So tonight, Bill and I are going to simplify the intricate world of flower anatomy into digestible insights for any level gardener. Emphasizing the relevance of understanding flower parts, we will investigate flowers and fruits, highlighting their functions and significance in plant life. And making the plants go forward as well.
So my goal tonight is just to give you a roadmap in, as I like to say sometimes in the seed schools that we do, is that these kinds of things don't have to be dark, scary forests.
Yeah.
That scare children. There are breadcrumbs and pathways in.
And one of my, I'm going to jump in here real quick. One of my biggest takeaways. So I've known you and Belle since the mid-aughts. And I did, in 2011, I did your residential 5-day seed school in Tucson. Mm-hmm. And then we did seed school online. You can find that at seedschoolonline.com. And what I've found is that this is a whole lot simpler than people want us to believe.
Yeah. Yeah. Otherwise, we wouldn't have so many different kinds of things. That's the evidence. That over 10,000 years with people who had no idea what genetics were,
right,
or rules, or what their county extension agent told them to do or not to do. Somehow, we took wild plants and turned them into the thousands of different kinds of edible things that we have today. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we did it just by saving seeds from the things that we liked. But that poses a question. How did they figure that out? How did they know to save seeds? And what are seeds and where did they come from? And it's like you look at the whole life cycle of a plant.
Mm-hmm.
Who figured that out? And that became pretty common knowledge pretty quickly. But what I'd like to do, let's just go out farther than that a little
bit. Please.
Because one of the things I like to point out to people that sometimes comes as a surprise to modern creatures is that all flowering plants produce seeds. We go into this when we do our wild seed lectures. People go, I don't know, where do I get the seeds to that? Unfortunately, for most of the wildflowers, most of us in North America will find out in the wilds behind our house or in a park or whatever, there are no seeds available. Or they're very rare, or they're expensive, or they're hard to get. And collecting them might be the only way you can do it. So if you want to start collecting seeds, where are they? That's the first question. What do they look like? It's different for every plant. But rest assured, every flowering plant produces seeds. So it's just a matter of looking at that point. All right. So what does that mean? All flowering plants are known as angiosperms.
Okay.
This is getting into taxonomy a bit and how we've divided the world into kingdoms, plants and animals, and the plant kingdom into certain different categories of plants. And there are those plants that don't produce seeds, and like mosses and lichen and algae. And then there's plants that do produce seeds. And a spermophyta, I think, is what they call that whole wing of the plant kingdom. And that spermophyta is divided into two branches. Plants that produce seeds without flowers and plants that produce seeds with flowers. And it turns out that flowers are a relatively late development.
Really?
In, in the evolution of the plant kingdom. So let me, one of my favorite quotes come from Eckhart Tolle. And this was in a book called A New Earth. And so just let me read this paragraph. He said, Earth, 114 million years ago. There's some questions as to whether that or not that might have been 130 million years ago. And this is based on fossils that we found, all right? 114 million years ago, one morning, just after sunrise, the first flower ever to appear on Earth opens up to receive the sun. Prior to this momentous event that heralds an evolutionary transformation in the life of plants, the planet had already been covered in vegetation for millions of years. The first flower probably did not survive for long, and flowers must have remained a rare and isolated phenomenon, since conditions were most likely not yet favorable for a widespread flowering to occur. One day, however, a critical threshold was reached, and suddenly there would have been an explosion of color and scent all over the planet if a perceiving consciousness had been there to witness it. So that's a really interesting statement. And so if we look back through the fossil record, we actually have a flowering plant still living over 100 million years ago, from what we can tell, that was a really close relative to that first flower. And it's called Amborella trichopoda. And it's found in New Caledonia in the South Pacific. And there's a link so that you can look. I found it through an article called Where Did All the Flowers Come From? By Carl Zimmer. It was in the New York Times. And you can see a picture of it and you can get a link to it. Mm-hmm. But that kind of takes you down into the what I hope to convey to everybody is that plants are changing. It's an evolution. There weren't always flowers, but once there were flowers, they were really simple flowers. Mm-hmm. And since we had simple flowers, they've gone on to evolve and complexify into different ecological niches all over the planet with different strategies for reproduction. And it gets really complicated. And to try to understand that then, we've created a science called taxonomy. Taxonomy is the science of categorizing things so that we can understand them. So plant taxonomy is what we're talking about tonight. This is a long ways around to getting back to flower parts, right? So we've come up with names, specific names for these little parts and flowers that have evolved and gotten more complex over time in order to help us tell different flowers apart from one another. Also to help us recognize them in our breed so that we can understand breeding systems and save our own seeds. So the New York Times article, Where Did All the Flowers Come From? That's in the chat now. And the link is there. You can press on it. If you want to learn more about taxonomy, there's a Wikipedia link that'll teach you about that, a little bit of an overview of it. You can look at what I was talking about, the flowering plants. Those are the angiosperms. You can see how they fit within the plant kingdom and get some overview about that. There's a link for you to do that. And then most importantly, I think for tonight, there's some links for some books that could help you learn how to identify flowers, basically. Mm-hmm. And I'm just pointing out, there are tons of them out there. There's all sorts of resources. You can get YouTubes or whatever. But these are the ones that have helped me most. And there's old school books. And when I go to try to find a book, I always go to bookfinder.com.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Because it'll give you all the sources and you get either new or used. And I always try to buy used books if I can, so I'm not wasting more paper or cutting down more trees. Try to buy around on the outside of the Amazon universe just because I want to keep that universe alive also. So if you really want to cut to the chase about how to identify plants and flowers, especially, How to Identify Plants by H.D. Harrington. This is the old school book, little drawings he did. I just found one on bookfinder.com, used one, $6.
Oh, nice.
So there's no reason why everybody who's a serious gardener and or seed saver shouldn't have one of those. And if you get into grasses, he wrote another little book called How to Identify Grasses and grass-like plants, which is just fabulous. You won't find the information on how to do that. Grasses are flowers. They have flowers. They're just different structures and have like weird names, lemmas and glooms. And so there's a whole nother language about it. And so there's a whole nother book to help you.
Nice. And while we're on grasses, just for a split second, I discovered 2 years ago here that grasses are also grains. So grains are grasses. So if you can grow grass, you can grow grains. And what's your shirt say, Bill?
Oh, a Grainiacs.
Yeah. There you go. Anyway, yeah.
That's where I'm ending up with grains. I'm living in a place that gets 2 inches of rainfall a year, and it's pure sand. And the first thing I did this fall when I got here was throw out a bunch of seeds. And you can't believe the grains that are growing, Greg. It's just unbelievable. They're grass. They just come up and take care of themselves everywhere. So just to add on to what you're doing. And then I highly recommend, if you want to be a learned person in this field, if you're playing with plants, then get a copy of Thomas J. Eppel's Botany in a Day. I just saw one, they're 18 bucks or so used. It's a bit more intensive a book. But what's great about this book for me is that over the last 20 years, it's crowdsourced its information. He was a teacher and he got students to help him with pictures and definitions and explanations that were easier, better, and clearer than the ones he was coming up with. So he finally put it online for a while and people from all over the world helped him make the book better.
Nice.
So this is our botany Wikipedia in a sense. And so that will really help you. These are over. I just want to give these overlays. So then let's just get down into the parts of a flower because there aren't that many that people have to be concerned. There are a lot more than simple diagrams. But I found a really clear diagram, the American Museum of Natural History. And so that's the next link I give you on there, parts of a flower. And you can click on that. And that'll give you a really simplified but standard picture of the parts of a flower. And it's important to understand those from a seed saving standpoint, because you want to know which parts produce pollen and which parts receive pollen. And that's important so that you can make sure that both of them are on one flower, or if they're not, is there another flower on the same plant that has the other part, the receiving part? Or if it's not there, is there a whole other plant that looks just like the one you have that has the other part to either give pollen or to receive pollen? And just depending on where you find it then will be how you control pollen. And controlling pollen is how you breed new varieties, say, or make sure that the ones that you have remain like the ones that you have. And so in that couple of sentences, I just summarized all of seed breeding and saving in a really simple way. So I could get into what's a receptacle, a sepal, a petal, a stamen, an anther, a pistil. I'm not going to go into those, but I think that chart in the link that I gave you is a really good one. And then the next link I put on there is from trees.com. And that's parts of a flower and their functions. And they start with categorizing the general kinds of flowers. Are they complete or incomplete? A complete flower has all the major parts. It's got sepals and petals. It's got a stamen and a pistil. The stamen being the part that produces pollen, the pistil, the part that receives it. The petals, the flowery part around it, and sepals are the kind of mini petals underneath. So if a flower is complete, it's got all of those things. If it's not, it's incomplete. And then another term that you'll hear a lot actually in plant breeding, is it a perfect flower or an imperfect flower? This is important to understand too, because you can cut to the chase and just ask people if you've got, say, something new and you want to be a seed saver, you go, oh, does that produce perfect flowers or imperfect? That'll give you the information you need so that you can control pollen more easily. And
But what's a perfect and an imperfect?
Well, a perfect flower has both the pollen producing and the pollen receiving parts, the stamen and the pistil on the same flower. All right, it's perfect. They're all right there. They may not be able to use their own pollen. There is self-incompatibility in some plants, but they're both right there. You can see them. An imperfect flower either has the pollen receiving in the little flower, and this would be like squash flowers. We have what we still call female squash flowers and male squash flowers.
Mm-hmm.
So they're imperfect. Either it has either or. All right.
But they're on the same plant.
They're on the same plant. It's about 10 to 1. I don't know if you've seen vining squash, but they'll keep throwing out flowers. And about every 10th one is a pollen receiving flower. And you can tell because there's a little baby squash on the peduncle or the little stem that holds the flower. Or if you're growing pot, as more and more people are, you'll know that the pollen producing is one whole plant, and the pollen receiving can be a whole other plant, a female plant.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Same with spinach. All right. And so you can control pollen rather easily with those, which is what they do in the pot growing industry. They've got their females, and they'll have whole warehouses full of females. And if there's a male plant in there, they'll pull it and get rid of it because they don't want their flowers to get fertilized. That way they get bigger and they get more bud and more money for what they're doing. However, and this is something about the plant world that we often say, almost universally, if you have a warehouse full of female plants, male flowers will start to appear on the female plants.
Really?
Yeah, there's some, it's like the call of the sirens. And male flowers start to appear. So you got to keep a sharp eye out. And that happens in a lot of different, that happens, I've heard, even in animals sometimes. That
I just saw an article here
for an aquarium in North Carolina.
That's what it.
With the stingray. Did you see that?
Yes, I heard that. That's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah, female stingray hasn't been with a male in 8 years, and she's pregnant and going to have four babies.
That's what I'm talking about.
It's like, how does this happen? That's nature.
So if you have separate plants with separate sexual functions, they're either called monoecious or dioecious.
Mm-hmm.
So a dioecious plant would be one that, like marijuana, like spinach, that has a completely separate plant with the male parts of the plants or the pollen producing and the pollen receiving is in a completely different plant. Okay. A monoecious plant is what, like squash, that produces both of them on the same plant.
So and tomatoes are monoecious then?
Tomatoes are monoecious and perfect.
Ah.
Yeah, so you can play with those ideas a little bit and that'll help loosen up your mind and that'll help you get into what we're talking about.
Right.
A little bit. All right. So I just want to add one more thing then. If you get into, and I highly recommend it, learn some Latin. Learn the Latin names of the plants you're playing with or the plants that you're identifying in your yard.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And why? People go, oh, God, it's hard enough. I don't want to, you're not going to make me learn another language. This stuff's hard enough. And there's value in it, though.
Yeah.
First of all, Latin names have incredible stories about the plants, usually, or the medicine in them, just by learning the name. So you're going to deepen your understanding of what's going on. But more importantly, then you can go anywhere and talk about those plants, anywhere in the world, and people will understand what you're talking about. If you just learn the common names of the plants that you're around and the variety names of the things growing in your garden, you can't transfer that knowledge outside of that area. Maybe that's fine for you.
Mm-hmm.
But most of us now are at least on a computer talking with people, and they could be anywhere in the world. And so that's really one of my calls. And if you really, then you fall into the rabbit hole. Then you start going, so what is the Latin name for this plant or that plant? And again, to come back around in a circle, that's taxonomy. And there are books. Once you go through the How to Identify Flower Parts books, but Harrington's, for instance, and you learn some of that language, then how do you use that to identify flowers. Those are called floras. And there have been floras written for almost every area of the world. And there are different ones at different times that are held to be the authority. Now, what you have to remember is the authority doesn't last very long. Why? New people come on with better microscopes. Now we have genes or whatever. And the plants change. Mm-hmm. They're still evolving. We're like trying to overlay this grid, this either or grid taxonomy. Either they're yellow flowers or they're purple ones. What happens if they're yellow and purple? Nature is wily and it keeps changing up. And so if you get into a native plant society, say, or a botanical gardens or other places where taxonomy is used a lot, you're walking into a den of arguments. Those people, that's all it is a big discussion, an argument, a free-flowing, evolving argument to try to keep up with all the changes that are going on, both from how we view it and from how the plants change themselves. And ask around, find the flora that is the authority in your region. Like when I was in Idaho, it was flora of the Rocky Mountain West was the latest one. When I was in college, there was flora of the Pacific Northwest. Hitchcock and Cronquist was taught in every botany class. And then it evolved into the Rocky Mountain one. Now we have flora of North America evolving. And it's online. And so I put a link there to it. And you can read about it and you can start to get into some of the things. All right.
I used to have an old copy of Flora of Arizona.
There you go. And I just got an old copy of the Flora of Baja California.
Ooh.
Which is really fun.
Yeah.
And a lot of the names now are outdated. We're starting to change some of the names, especially of the genuses.
You mean the Latin names are getting
changed? The Latin names, we're starting to change.
Wow.
Yeah, no, don't do that to me. After you go ahead and memorize them all, it's like, But they have good reasons to do it, and it's just another game. And then they have what they call synonyms. It's still honorable to use the old names. Mm-hmm. People look at you like, oh, you're old school, aren't you? And that's with our cell phones.
I was going to say, it's got to be like Seek the app and...
Seek. So yes. The app I use is called Seek, S-E-E-K.
Yep.
And it's linked to another app called iNaturalist.
Yep.
Or iNat. And iNat's great. It's a social network of botanists who will see what you Seek will help come up with a name for a plant, given where you are at the time you are. It's most likely to be this flower, given the shapes or whatever. But you may not be right, and Seek can be wrong. So when you post it to iNaturalist, really good botanists who keep an eye on things will come down and go, oh, no, I made that mistake too. That is not that. It's this. And they'll write a little note to it. Or they'll say, oh, yeah, you're right. That's it. And once you get a couple of those people to certify your observation, then it'll be what they call research grade. Then other people can depend on it for being what it is, your picture, all right? So you can join the community immediately and you can find the people that want to do this. And you can take pictures and seek out all the flowers in your garden and everything around you and start posting it so we can build this network of people and learn from each other, all right?
And the thing is that it uses the camera on your phone, for the people that don't know how it works, it uses the camera on your phone and it does a survey of the data that it has had collected on different shapes and colors and all that kind of stuff. The thing is, it's not just about plants.
I
was listening to a podcast maybe 6-8 months ago about these two high school students that discovered a new scorpion.
Wow.
Through this process.
And, wow. I love it. See?
Yeah.
So, well, they still figured that there are hundreds of thousands of flowering plants that have not been categorized properly still. There's lots of adventure out there. So, So I hope everyone will get into that a little bit. This all starts with your flower parts. Learn those. That's the basics. ABCs, there's about 12 of them. And then start looking at them. Every flowering plant, open them up. Look at the same plant to see if there's dried up flower pods, because those could have seeds. Learn how to identify the plants around you in all their seasons. Become seed savvy in a sense, so you don't need the flower to know what the plant is. Mm-hmm. Unlike taxonomy, and wow, you're on your way, a lifetime of adventure.
Bill, you wrote and I helped create a course called Seed School Online. And you can find out about it at seedschoolonline.com. And right now we've got it on sale for $29, which it's wow. Can tell us a little bit about what Seed School is, because it's relevant to what we're talking about today.
There's a module in there on wild plants.
Yep.
For one thing, but and there's a whole module where we show you all the flower parts and we talk about why it's important to learn them and how that helps you hack any kind of seed breeding, if you know the family especially, because almost all families reproduce in the same way. So if you understand what family your plant's in, then you automatically, you learn how to save the seeds, you automatically learn how to save the seeds for the whole family. So that's just one of the, that's an example of what's in there and what's in the course. It's just been my, I just spent 40 years trying to teach people how to save seeds. And that evolved into seed schools. And those seed schools then evolved into seed schools in a day. And we took all that information, all the feedback from all the students and all the stuff we got. And I synthesized it down into an online course. And that's what you're talking about. So it's got a lot of experience built into the structure.
Yeah.
Why waste time going into all sorts of stuff? We don't go down rabbit holes. We teach you how to cut to the chase quickly and get up and running. In fact, we've had students come in that weren't even gardeners that now own seed companies after that course. So it's inspirational also.
Yeah.
It was meant to be life-changing because it changed ours. We were doing this in real time with all those students there and all the questions and all the incredible people around, man. We just got caught up in it.
Yeah.
Wow. I really believe that learning these things is important. We've been in our technological cocoons now, and they're getting better. They even put it on your head, right? With the new Apple thing, 3D, create whole new realities, and we just sit in there. And it just hasn't been good for our own biology. We got more sick people that can't eat bread, that have to go to the gluten-free aisles, that a third of all females and half of all males in the United States are on track right now to get cancer. Things aren't normal. What are they? There's 7,000 forever chemicals out there in million-pound quantity. There's all this shit going on. You can't just pretend that normal's normal, and you can. And with the changes we're seeing economically and politically, and we're coming back to sourcing our goods and services closer. Nearshoring is a new term. Understanding how things work in your own backyard. I'm not a doomsday survivalist. I'm more like walk outside and go, oh my effing God, look at all this neat stuff going on.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to understand if we're going to collectively learn how to emit less carbon and save ourselves some real woes in the next 20 years, we're going to have to understand how it works right around us. And how we get our food in the most efficient way, for one thing, and our medicine. And all of this is tied into that. I think that's a motivation underlying it. I hope things never get hard, that we always have stores full of stuff or whatever. But if we don't, then we'll be prepared for that too.
So we got a couple of questions now. Is KJR says, is saving seeds from lemons and apples useful?
Of course.
Yeah, I can answer that in my way. How would you answer it?
They're both could have a million different fathers.
Right.
So you don't know what you're getting. And every apple could have a different father on an apple tree and grow up a different variety of apple. In fact, there's estimates that there were 25,000 different varieties of apples growing in the United States.
Do you know why?
When this Declaration of Independence was signed. Why? Tell me.
Johnny Appleseed was a real person. And what he would do is he would arrive at the cider mills and purchase the seeds and take them in front of the settlers and would plant them.
Right.
So that when the settlers arrived, he would sell them apple trees for a few cents. And what that was doing is that was taking the genetic mixture of cross-pollination of apples and giving us thousands of different kinds of apples.
Right. Yeah. And so, yes, it's very useful for that. What it's not useful for, and this is really important, we have grown up in an industrial agricultural system. And so much of our mindset around things like this has been determined by it and what's good for the industrial system. Is saving your own apple or lemon seed useful? No, for that. No, they know exactly what variety. They're growing a million acres of each of them, and they're patented in some cases, and they control it, right? And you get them in your grocery store. Is it useful for you to play around and come up with a new variety? Hell yeah. Because especially if you're doing cider, who cares what it looks like or if the flavor's slightly off? It just depends on what you're going to do. Yeah, there's a really great story about Myers Lemon. Myers was like a 22-year-old who was sent out by the USDA around the world to collect seeds and got himself into Siberia and got into trouble. It was like, help, Mr. Wizard. And they had to bail him out and bring him home. He was just a wild kid. But he brought back one lemon tree from one place in Arabia somewhere. And everybody liked it. And that became Myers Lemon. That's what they named it after him. That's just one variety. Nice. And every single one is a clone from that. That's how they reproduce citrus, is they clone it. Because if you do sexual reproduction and save the seeds, you could get something different. I say it's time for a diversity party, again, like Johnny Appleseed. Every area, I think wealth will be determined by how much diversity you have. It's the one thing we're losing at record rates on this planet that we'll never get back. It's like Bitcoin's in reverse. It'd be like taking them away every year instead of minting only a certain number.
All right. Two more questions. It's essentially the same question. And I'm going to tell both of you, we're going to touch on it lightly today.
Okay.
But we have an event coming up in March called Seed Up Saturday. It's a 3-hour event on, I can't remember the date. It's a Saturday. If you're getting our Seed Chat emails, you'll get an email about Seed Up Saturday. But the question is, KJR says, is there a particular way to store the apple and lemon seeds for later use? And Brenda wants to know, can you please tell what the best way to successfully store seeds and how long they would be viable? Both these questions are the most asked questions and an hour-long conversation. So give me 3 minutes.
I'll give you, store them cool, dark, and dry, and they could last for centuries, even in a clay pot. We know, we have evidence of that. And clay, store them in a clay pot, and they can last for a long time. Again, that industrial mindset, you need fresh seed every year. Go down to the store and buy it. No. Almost all seeds will last for decades, even garden seeds in your home.
Yes.
Even seeds that have been misused in some cases, but if you'll keep them cool, dark, and dry, as I like to say, we've been routinely got 90% germination on 10-year-old tomato seed.
There you go.
And we were storing them without refrigeration.
Katina wants to know, this is a good question. What about seeds from a bag of pinto beans or a jar of mustard seeds? Are they just as easy to use as apple and lemon seeds?
Yes.
But there's going to be, generally with vegetable seeds, the diversity isn't as much as it is from like an apple
seed. No, you're right. The diversity part we're talking about isn't the same. In fact, beans are self-pollinating, largely self-pollinating flowers. You'll get the same bean varieties in almost every case. If there's an off type, you'll see it. I have a friend, Thunderfoot, who only keeps the seeds to the off types. He's created a variety called Anomaly. And they're all different shapes and colors. It's great. Yeah.
Nice. All right, Bill, any final thoughts?
I think anomaly. That's my final thought. Be strange, be weird, be outside the boundaries, be like the plants outside of you, be promiscuous, make stuff up, mess stuff up, bring more diversity in, save seeds from everywhere all the time that you can. Don't get overly obsessed with how perfect to plant them or to care for them. We don't want them anyway now. We don't want those prissy babies. We want things that are sturdy, that'll come up and grow, even though we're abusive to it. Yeah. That's what we're looking for. This whole thing could be a lot more fun. I think American gardeners don't have enough fun. We're too worried about stuff.
Exactly.
We take the worry from our other life and try to apply it to our gardens. It's just let go, man. Go out and eat a flower. Relax. Have some fun.
Right. Peggy says, I've been germinating carrot seeds from 2015. That's 9 years old. Yes. Donna says, really great information tonight. So appreciated. Thanks, Bill and Greg. Always look forward to it. Brenda says, thank you both for the great chat.
Yeah. I think you can come back to this when it comes out on a podcast.
Yep.
And those links will be there. It took me decades to figure out that stuff that I just did. You spew it out now and it sounds easy, but it took a long time to find out what's important. Pick through and find out what's important. I hope that'll be important to you.
Perfect. Thank you, Bill. And we'll see you all in Seed Chat next month.
All right. Take care, Bill, everybody. All right.
Bye, guys. Bye-bye. Appreciate you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Urban Farm Podcast. Remember to listen for tips, advice, and resources to help you on your journey with urban farming. You can find us on the web at urbanfarm.org or send us an email to podcast@urbanfarm.org. In the words of Vincent Van Gogh, great things are done by a series of small things brought together. Be encouraged that with each lesson learned and skill developed, you are one step closer in the direction of your dreams.